It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about cheese. Later in the hour, cheese eating and cheese making in Iowa. I'll talk with C.J. Bienert, co-owner of the Cheese Shop in Des Moines, and Sharon Omek of Honey Creek Creamery. She makes goat cheese. But first, we're going to start with a very specific kind of cheese, cheddar. Gordon Edgar is a cheesemonger and the main cheese buyer for San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery Cooperative. He's the author of Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Hello, Gordon.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, no, thanks for having me.
Now, what started your exploration of cheddar cheese? I know it's everywhere, of course, but what made you want to find out more about the history of this cheese?
Well, you know, I've been working in cheese for, 21 years now. And, we're in the midst of this kind of great American cheese renaissance, this time period when more people are making more different types of cheese with more different types of milk. And it's just a really special time. There's just a lot of really great, especially small production cheeses being made that just weren't even being thought about 20 years ago. But then I started to think, well, why did we need this kind of cheese renaissance? You know, why were we at a place where this wasn't happening before? And I realized when I started looking into that a little bit that the key to understanding that was cheddar, and the way that cheddar became kind of an industrial, well, it became a factory product and then kind of more of an industrial product through the late 1800s, and really came to dominate cheese production in the United States.
And this, we'll talk more about where American cheese, what we call American cheese, at least, came from. But is that supposed to be a variation of cheddar?
Yeah, basically. Originally, when you processed cheese, first of all, processed cheese, is 100 years old at this point. There's very few people on the planet who are alive longer than processed cheese.
And it lasts that long, too.
It lasts that long, too. Yeah, maybe the original processed cheese. But it's definitely been a thing for a while. And when I was doing research, I was kind of fascinated because I just think of it. I grew up on Kraft Singles and Velveeta, like most people of my generation. But I just thought of it as, oh, this was something just invented in a factory, in a big factory where nobody touches any cheese and all that kind of stuff. But when I was doing research, I was kind of fascinated to find that there used to be these recipes for making, American cheese or making processed cheese, which involved, very specific amounts of, aged, cheddar, that was really high quality mixed in with very young cheddar to kind of bulk it out. And then, the cooking process. So it used to be this thing that was actually people, would make in small factories, for their local communities and stuff like that. And used to take a lot more kind of pride in the flavor of it, and it's definitely not really that anymore, but it definitely is originally an offshoot of cheddar.
Now, of course, cheddar is the name. Cheddar comes from the town in England where it was first made. So how did it become an American cheese? When did it come here?
Well, it came here when people started emigrating from England, but it really and it had been cheese made around cheddar had been happening since like the 11th century. It was based on a French cheese called Cantal. But what really kind of changed for cheddar was with technological advancements in the 1800s or in the mid 1800s. And America was the first country to have the idea of putting it in a factory. What we have to understand at this time period, all cheese before 1850 or so, pretty much all cheese was made on the farm. It was a job of the farm wife. It was, people made it for their own consumption, maybe trade with the neighbors. Some people, made larger production and they'd maybe hire a few people to help. But everything was made on the farm with people's own cows. There was no transportation of milk. What happened in upstate New York and in 1851 is the Williams family decided, well, we're going to centralize production, basically, and we're going to build a factory just to make cheese. And we're going to have all our neighbors, form a co-op, and they're all going to bring us milk, and we're going to share the profits of the cheese, and that'll be a better way to make cheese and better for everyone. And it takes one task off the farm wife's plate, was how it was often
portrayed. Well, you shared this wonderful poem in your book that was supposedly first printed in 1864, The Dairyman's Courtship.
Yeah.
And the whole poem, I'll read the first couple of stanzas. It says, "My dear little Katie, my purse is not weighty, 100 broad acres for keeping the cows, a snug house and dairy, then say you will marry me now, Katie, darling, my neat little spouse. Dear Henry, my jewel, I think you're not cruel. Some leisure you're fond of as well as the news. Your housework and dairy I could or never could carry. The bare contemplation, sir, gives me the blues." And it's all about how she would marry him if she didn't have to make cheese.
Right. Well, and it's actually, it's funny. When I was doing a reading here, I really wanted to have someone come up and read that with me. We'd do like a duet, but but so far nobody has volunteered.
Well, I'll come to your next one. We'll do it.
When I do a reading in Des Moines, you should come and play Katie's part.
All right.
but yeah, and it's funny. I don't know about the legitimacy of that poem. I mean, it's funny because there's really no way to trace that back. But but it definitely was something that was one of the ways they sold the whole concept of the cheese factory was as a way of releasing drudgery, farm drudgery, less farm drudgery. Somewhere else would make the cheese, one task off your plate, basically.
Well, and what created this need for cheese? Because you describe how not only was a lot of cheddar being made in the United States, it was actually being exported back to England as well, which kind of boggles the mind a little bit. But what was the need that cheese making and cheese factories were filling when they first started appearing?
Well, I think a couple of needs. One, obviously just feeding people. I mean, the whole process of cheese making is, you're taking this fresh but very perishable protein of milk, and you're transforming it into something that can last a long time and you can eat later. So it's kind of in some ways it's kind of a pillar of civilization. It's like you're planning ahead. You're planning ahead to the hard winter or whatever. But the other thing was that, especially in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin drove a lot of the advance in cheese factories. They had basically stripped their land. That Wisconsin in the early 1800s was known for wheat production. But it became such a monoculture, and it became, the land just was not giving the yields that it used to give, and people were going bankrupt. People were not being able to survive there. So they kind of had to figure out something else, some other way to make a living. And the dairy cow was it. The dairy cow basically saved or made Wisconsin, depending on how you want to think about it. And that's why Wisconsin is so aligned with cheese today, why they take such pride in it too. It really did, starting in the mid 1800s, really start to change that state and provide a good agricultural alternative.
And when these factories first started appearing in the United States, they were turning out good quality cheese, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at cheddar too, especially cheddar, there's a whole series of like technological advancements that were made, and a lot of them were made through sharing of best practices and cooperation between, even England and the United States, but also, farmers in different regions. Taking cheese making to the cheddar factory really provided a lot of benefits. One is, it got it away from the animals. And there's the people of that time didn't necessarily know why. There wasn't quite the same understanding of foodborne pathogens and that kind of stuff. But taking a food production away from a place where there'll be animal manure around and things like that, it seems obvious to us today, but
right, that might improve things. Yeah.
So a lot of cheddar really increased in quality once it went to these kind of factories. And these kind of factories, let's be honest here, these kind of factories were still very hands-on factories. Any of them would be accepted in any artisan cheese guilds today. These aren't like, we were a number of decades away from, pressing a button and cheese coming out an hour later,
So I mentioned that we were actually exporting cheddar cheese to England. That was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was. It's funny because, that kind of blew me away. As someone who, when I started working in cheese in the 1990s, you know, we were in San Francisco, so we have probably more snobby customers than you do in Iowa.
No.
but there was a number of people who would come in and if they were trying to impress someone, they'd be like, oh, well, no American cheese. You know, we don't want anything from America. It has to be European. The idea that any cheese made in America would be exported to one of what we consider like, you know, the real cheese making countries, you know, was kind of absurd. And so when I found out that actually, America had been exporting, you know, the tons and tons of cheese to England, you know, the home of cheddar, that was definitely kind of a revelation. And then I was like, well, what happened? I mean, why haven't we been a cheese export nation since, you know, 1875 or whatever?
And what you asked was, what did America do to screw it up?
Well, what did we do to screw it up? You know, and it was unfortunately, it was greed. Some cheddar producers started replacing the butterfat in the cheese with cheap vegetable oil. This thing that's called, it actually has a name, which is called filled milk cheese. But it was not received very well. And United States cheese became synonymous with just bad quality as an export product.
Well, so and you also discovered that in England, if the cheese was good and coming from America, they would label it as English cheddar. And if it was bad and coming from America, that's the American cheddar, right?
Well, yeah, you always have to find your reputable cheesemonger, for sure. but yeah, no, that definitely was another part of it.
Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're talking about the history of cheddar cheese in the United States. My guest is Gordon Edgar. His book is Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese and What It Can Tell Us About Our History, Cultural Identity, and Food Politics. He's also the main cheese buyer for San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery Cooperative. Coming up in a few minutes, we're also going to focus on cheese in Iowa, where there's been a real cheese renaissance. CJ Bienert will be here. He's a cheesemonger and co-owner of the Cheese Shop in Des Moines. And also Sharon Omek, a cheese maker from Honey Creek Creamery, will be here as well. And you can join the conversation with your questions, your comments. What's your favorite Iowa cheese? We'd love to hear about it. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about cheese. With me, Gordon Edgar. He is the author of the new book, Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Also joining us now is CJ Bienert. He is a cheesemonger. He's also co-owner of the Cheese Shop in Des Moines. Hello, CJ.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome to the show. And now I've got two cheesemongers on the show.
It's a special day.
Absolutely. I think anytime you can call somebody a monger, it's a pretty good day. I want to talk to both of you about where we are with cheese today. And so, Gordon, let's do a little bit of encapsulating of history. We talked about where things started to go wrong as we mass produced cheese and people were making filled cheese product, which took away the butterfat and put in oil. And, of course, a lot of people are familiar with processed cheese and the product that that is. When did we start to have kind of a renaissance of cheese? I mean, I'm sure people were always making great cheese in the United States. But when did this renaissance that we're benefiting from now start?
Well, it's definitely started in the 70s, I'd say. But, you know, there's kind of two different effects that caused it. You know, one is kind of just the farm crisis in the United States. There's only 10% of the amount of dairy farms now that there were in 1950. Cheese production really consolidated as well. And with cheddar particularly, it used to be kind of a regional thing. You know, like even big companies like Kraft or whoever would be buying cheese from small producers, you know, throughout their regions. And then something that I like to call the cheddar apocalypse happened, which was that all of a sudden, with 30 days notice, they stopped buying from all these little producers. So, you know, all of a sudden people had to figure out what to do if they were going to survive as cheesemakers. And a lot of them started to really diversify the type of cheese they made. And that was kind of in combination with kind of 60s, 70s, back to the land, stuff where people were kind of looking again at farmstead cheeses, you know, cheeses made on their own farm as a way to be a sustainable farmer and live a rural lifestyle and be able to survive. So kind of those two things started to come together in the 70s and 80s. And after, you know, a couple decades of cheese that, you know, cheese takes a while to perfect, you know, we really started seeing the benefit of this, especially in the late 90s. Till today, and cheese is just getting better and better in the United States.
Absolutely. And well, CJ, you can weigh in on this. I mean, as a cheesemonger, I know that you and I have talked about Iowa cheeses in the past. Iowa has really experienced a cheese renaissance in the last decade, probably. But when you started in the business, was there an idea that all good cheese had to come from Europe?
Oh, very much so. Granted, you know, Des Moines is not San Francisco. We still had those snootier customers that only wanted Eurocentric cheese. It would always mispronounce, you know, Epois or something. And that time, in about early 2000, we were selling, you know, loads of those cheeses. And the American artisan cheese was really kind of at a price point in just such small quantity, it just wasn't really obtainable. And in the last 10 years, now our shop specializes in American artisan cheese, with our inventory being over 70%. So it's a really exciting time to be a cheesemonger in America.
Did you have to go through a little bit of an awakening as well as someone who loves cheese? I mean, of course, there's all this amazing history in Europe.
Yeah, the story's great for me. It started with a piece of cheese called Winamere, and I know Gordon knows this cheese very well.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in that Eurocentric counter, and I had a piece, and it set me back, and I couldn't believe it was made in Vermont. And it sent me on a journey, actually, to Vermont, where I did an internship with the farm that makes the cheese, Jasper Hill. And in Vermont, they have such that, you know, back-to-the-land kind of movement and artisan food movement. It really opened my eyes to American artisan cheese. And instead of staying in Vermont, I thought, hey, I'm going to bring this back to Iowa. This is really, really cool. And that's really been the mission of the shop and the vision.
And tell me about Winamere cheese. What's make so special about it?
Well, it's a raw milk cheese that's only made in the winter months when there's a dry diet being fed to the cows. So you get a higher amount of protein and fat. And it's all wrapped in a cambium bark. So it's kind of bacony and smoky, modeled after a very famous cheese from Europe called Vacheron. That's not really obtainable here. So it's really the perfect example of what we can do. We don't have to try to obtain these cheeses that are in such small quantity. We can just make them ourselves here and make them, I think, even better.
And Gordon, did you have to go through an awakening as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I started in cheese, I mean, I think that our, you know, and I work in a you know, grocery store cooperative, so it's not just a cheese shop. But you know, we probably had 20% American cheese and 80% European, and now I'd say that's probably almost flipped on its head. So I think that's really really definitely shows where we're at with American cheese. With me, you know, I kind of had you know, Winamere is also a very important cheese to me as well. But for me, I think it was California goat cheeses. And, you know, it's because I live in California. But you know, I was just kind of blown away. You know, I was like, this is, you know, I grew up never even thinking that you could milk a goat, you know. It just never really occurred to me. You know, the first time I tried those, I was like, whoa, these are, you know, there's no reason to buy this prepackaged French, you know, goat cheese, you know, Chev, you know, from Europe, when we have this here in California. I mean, why would you bring it 8,000 miles, you know, and definitely a revelation.
Well, and since your newest book is about cheddar, we'll talk about many different kinds of cheeses today. But with cheddar, you write about an experience where you get a lot of food tourism in San Francisco, of course. And you talk about, you know, someone coming in someone whose opinions you would respect about cheese. And she asked you to, you know, give her a sample of your best cheeses, but no cheddar. So was there an additional awakening with cheddar?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was. I mean, I think to me, you know, that incident where somebody came in and they wanted to, you know, they were giving a gift, I think, even to the people they were staying with. And there was like, no cheddar. I never served cheddar. And I was like, where are you coming from? Because to me, you know, not only is cheddar a great cheese, I mean, it's kind of famous for a reason, and especially if you look at the cloth-bound, more traditional varieties, I mean, the depth of flavor of those cheeses is on par with any great cheese made in the world. But to me, to cut that off is really, to just like, you know, really miss out on a lot. I mean, there's a reason that, I mean, at our shop, I often use cheddar as almost a gateway cheese. You know, it's like everybody's familiar with cheddar. So, you know, if I say, hey, you know, well, here, try this, you know, you've had this block cheddar, you know, that we're used to eating, you know, try this traditional style cheddar. You know, it's cloth bound, it never gets as sharp, but it has much more complexity. And that really opens people's eyes to cheese all the time, you know, when they see a familiar cheese in a different way.
Can you define block cheddar for me? Because we obviously don't buy it in quite the same way as you do.
Well, you know, basically, it's I think the easiest way to think about it is, and these all happen through different technological advances over time, but at the store, generally, you have cheese that has no rind, you have cheese that is waxed, and you have cheese that has a natural rind in terms of cheddar. And the one that has a natural rind is what we would call traditional, because it's aged with cheesecloth and rotated and can't really age as long as the kind of rindless cheddar or block cheddar, which is aged in plastic. And it's made in 40-pound or 640-pound blocks. And then kind of just aged in plastic in a warehouse until it's time to be sold to a retailer and cut up. So yeah, that's basically the difference. But it's about advancements in cheese. You know, at first it was cloth bound, then it was waxed, then it was these kind of rindless 40-pound blocks.
Well, and in your book, you said you wanted to put in a simple version of how to make cheddar cheese. You did not do that because there's no simple version of how to make cheddar cheese. It's a pretty complicated process.
It is. And there's also, you know, the other complicated thing is that there's also many different, you know, there's different steps you can skip or alter, especially if you're making a large production cheese. So it often varies. But I think there's a couple of parts of the process that are really specific to cheddar. And again, it's about taking that original milk, removing as much moisture as possible from that milk so that the protein can last a long time and so that you can eat it at a later date. So there's a heating process, which is called the scald with cheddar. And most famously, there's the fact that cheddar can be also a verb, which is that after you, you know, when you have milk, you coagulate the milk, you have curds and whey, and then the cheese is made from the curds. And what you do with cheddar is that you cut those curds into slabs, and then you stack them on top of each other to further, you know, that weight helps exude more moisture from the cheese as well, makes it so you can age it a longer time.
Well, and the description of just that description of how to make cheddar cheese, I mean, CJ, cheese making, it is an incredibly complicated process. And we'll talk with a goat cheese maker here in a little while, which if you're making fresh cheese, it's a little bit less complicated. But in this resurgence of artisan cheeses, I mean, these are people who are really going to great lengths to bring this product to market, aren't they?
Oh, most definitely. One of the most noted cheeses here in Iowa and awarded cheeses is a cheddar as well, I'd like to point out. And it's also our number one selling cheese, Prairie Breeze.
And that's from Milton Creamery. That's...
Yeah, in southern Iowa. And it's a cheese we should be very proud of here in Iowa. It's part of this resurgence in American artisan cheese. But we're also seeing, you know, a lot of cheesemongers and, you know, younger individuals that are wanting to go and make cheese and live on a farm. Again, we're seeing that back to the farm movement. And it's really exciting because, you know, at some point I hope to have our shop be 100% American artisan and really be a regional shop for the Midwest.
And you write about Prairie Breeze in your book, Gordon, and we invited them to come on the show today, but they felt like they couldn't be a part of it. But Gordon, this is it's a pretty amazing cheese, but you write about it also. It's a pretty special product.
It really is. You know, it's kind of what I consider this kind of new school of cheddar. One of the ways you make cheddar too is that you add cultures to a cheese, and part of the cultures are in the cheese making process. They help the cheese become cheese, but others are to add flavor. And there's kind of this new wave in American, well, not just American cheddar making, but kind of all over the world of making these really nice sweet, sharp cheddars. And Prairie Breeze is I think, the best example of that in the United States. It is a cheese that we, for a long time in San Francisco, we got it through a distributor, believe it or not, in New York, because nobody local was carrying it. And people were calling us up and be like, hey, I live in Los Angeles, but I'm going to be in San Francisco, and I heard you have this cheese. Can you save it for me? You know, so there's a lot of desire for that Prairie Breeze, and it definitely is one of my favorite cheddars as well.
Well, and CJ, I know you have to leave us in a few minutes, so give us some recommendations. What are, and you don't have to limit yourself entirely to Iowa, but if I was going to put together a cheese plate this holiday season and wanted to have some really remarkable cheeses from Iowa and the Midwest, what would you recommend?
Our local goat cheese producers are amazing in supporting those local producers. We work with, the closest producer. We don't work with Honey Creek 100%, but Lois Reichardt of Reichardt's Dairy Air, a close friend of the shop. She's actually doing some beautiful fresh pyramids for us. She has some goats that are just not giving up. They're continuing to produce milk. She thinks they might go all winter, and it's really exciting. So we worked out a deal with her where she's custom making some cheeses for our shop. And then she makes a Robiola that is it's first rate to an Italian, northern Italian Robiola, all from her farmstead goat's milk. So that would be one, I think, mixing it up. So you have the softer, goat cheese, one of the firmer aged cheeses. The Banstras do a really great job at Frisian Farms in Oskaloosa making a traditional howdah, and they do some really, really nice aged howdah, and they just redeveloped kind of some of their practices in affinage and the cheese aging, which is a large part of cheese.
And I should mention, just in case people get confused, those of us who are not mongers usually call that Gouda.
Yeah, Gouda, Gouda, or Howdah, we like to interchange all that. But yeah, and their aged cheeses are really, they're pretty remarkable. I think in the next year, you're going to see some really, really great aged Howdah cheeses coming from Frisian Farms. And then Milton Creamery has a project with the Missouri Dairy that's really exciting. It's this cloth-bound, like Gordon was talking about, more traditional cheese made in a truckle. So a wheel really that is taller than it is wide. So it looks somewhat like a thimble. And it's a much drier, more complex, slightly earthy kind of take on that sweeter new school cheddar. So it's really a hybrid of the two. And we've just been loving all the batches that we've been getting at the shop as well.
And if we were looking for that, would that also be under Milton Creamery, or does it have a different?
Yes. Milton has taken really the marketing side of it. It's another Mennonite farm that just doesn't feel that it's their place with the marketing and sales. So they actually make the cheese, and then it's a unique relationship because then the cheese is aged in Iowa and marketed by Milton Creamery.
All right. And we have a question, since I've got two cheesemongers on the line. This one's from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. She says, I've become somewhat addicted to Irish porter beer cheddar, brown rind, brown lacy veins, and I can only find it occasionally. Is there a particular season for this cheddar, or if I'm just going to the wrong retailers?
I find it's, mainly the retailers are kind of looking at the season of St. Patrick's Day in beer and just the marketing of that cheese. We don't really work with flavored cheeses. My suggestion is just to get a nice porter and a piece of cheese. I don't know if Gordon has a better idea.
No, that's a great idea, especially when you can't find that one. But I agree. That's a cheese that, it's not seasonal, but I think they make a lot more of it around St. Patrick's Day, and they certainly bring a lot more into the country around then.
Well, in talking about the aging process that some of these great cheeses have to go through, is it hard to get enough of it to sell, CJ?
Very much. I mean, we're lucky with our producers. We buy complete batches or make commitments just on a handshake on batches of cheese that are, really allocated throughout the country. But with our regional producers, they really want to work with us in our shop. So it's part of what makes our shop special, and it's really the vision of, bridging the gap between the producer and the consumer.
All right. Well, CJ Bienert, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
CJ Bienert is a cheesemonger and co-owner of the Cheese Shop in Des Moines. And we're going to go to a break here in just a moment. But can you, Gordon, help me start to build a holiday cheddar plate? What are some of your favorite cheddars?
Oh, sure. Well, I definitely would agree with CJ on the Flory's truckle. I think that's a great cheese. That's actually one of my favorites. We carry that all the time, too. I think that, you know, mixing things up a little bit, you know, you have some of these great aged block cheddars, you know, especially from Wisconsin. You can get the Hooks, you know, 5 to 15 year cheddars. You know, California, I love the Fiscalini Farms cheddar. It's more traditional. It's the most traditional English tasting of any of the cloth-bound American cheddars. And then Vermont, you know, there's regional differences in cheddar, so you really can taste different things and different cheeses. And I think that, you know, if you really want to taste the taste of the Northeast, then it's definitely the Grafton 2-year to 4-year.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Gordon Edgar. He is the author of the book Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. I'll also talk with cheesemaker Sharon Omek of Honey Creek Creamery in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about cheese. And with me is Gordon Edgar. He's the author of Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. He's also a cheesemonger and the main cheese buyer for San Francisco Rainbow Grocery Cooperative. And we were talking about some of the more specialized cheddars that you might put on a holiday cheddar plate. What about some of the brand names that we are more familiar with in the United States, something that may not come wrapped in cloth, but also has really wonderful flavor?
You know, I think that there's a couple of really good producers that are available in almost any grocery store. And that's, you know, the Cabot cheeses, I think, are really high-quality Vermont cheddars. They definitely, depending on how aged they are, they have more or less of a sharp bite. But, you know, they're really pretty well-made. And also Tillamook. I assume that gets out to Iowa, because they make a lot of cheese. But, you know, Tillamook Co-op in Oregon makes really really good, you know, cheddar. It's not necessarily as strong as the ones in the Northeast, but it's definitely good.
Now, in talking about the renaissance of cheesemaking in the United States, you write about one particular cheesemaker, and the name escapes me at the moment, whose family had been making cheese for generations, and his father and grandfather felt so strongly about him not getting in the cheese business that they tried to shut down the operation before he could become a cheesemaker. And he's really embraced this new cheese movement. Give us a thumbnail sketch of his story, and I think it's quite emblematic of what's been going on.
Yeah, that's Chris Raleigh from the Raleigh Cheese Company, and that's Raleigh is spelled R-O-E-L-L-I. He's in Wisconsin, and that's exactly what happened. He went off to ag school, and before he came back, his family decided to shut down the cheddar factory because they were just making so little on their cheese that they didn't want to consign him to this life of you know, increasingly hard life of trying to make a living in that. I mean, if you look at the scale of cheese making, you get a place like, say, Hillmar Cheese Company in California makes 1 million pounds of cheese a day. And if you're making a penny or two on your pound of cheese, but you're making 1 million, you know, pounds of cheese a day, you know, you'll be okay. But if you're some small producer who's producing, you know, a couple hundred pounds a day, and you're making a penny or two a pound on your cheese, you know, it's going to be a hard living to make. So Chris, his family actually, they kind of stayed in the dairy business. They did a lot of milk transport and things like that. But he kind of secretly started experimenting around with making cheese, and in doing so, he created something that's pretty much a new cheese. It was. If you look at these traditional, like, cloth-bound cheddars, the rinds are natural rinds, like I said. And what does that mean? That means that there's no plastic or wax or anything on the outside. And a lot of them get this natural defects where some blue cheese will come in, you know, where there'll be a hole in the cheese and it'll start to mold a little bit. And you get a little bit of blue cheese towards the rind. A lot of people really like that with their traditional cheddars. What Chris did was he made a traditional cheddar and intentionally introduced mold so that it was a blue cheddar. And it's a really special cheese. It's called Dunbarton Blue. And then he also has another version called Red Rock, which is a little milder version. And they're really special cheeses and really emblematic of the whole cheese renaissance of, like, you know, you can't really make a living as a small producer making 40-pound blocks of cheddar anymore. So what are you going to do? You're going to get creative and make something really interesting and that you taste the quality in. And I think that that's a really great example of that.
Let's turn to a cheesemaker now. Sharon Omek is on the line from Honey Creek Creamery in the Lus Hills here in Iowa. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, every cheesemaker has a different story, and I think yours is definitely unique. What led you to cheesemaking?
Well, I had been working at the Federal Reserve, of all places, and I kind of, no offense to bankers, but I found that goats were a little easier colleagues and a little more fun characters to be around, and I actually enjoy the culinary people. They're very creative, and we bought my husband's great-grandfather's farm, came back to the farm.
All right. So you had had some goat experience before deciding to get into the cheese-making business?
Yes, I've had goats about 20 years. I got them from when I lived in Boulder and pretty much just had them as hiking companions.
Okay, so buddies.
Yes.
Were you nervous at all about turning this into a business prospect?
I was. I wanted to do one thing and do it really well, and so I did go to Cal Poly. San Luis Obispo has a cheese school, so I went there, and it was good because, you know, just learning the science of cheese, the viscosity of milk changes as the season changes, so you kind of need to know how to adapt, and mainly just the fear of, this is food, and it's things people eat, and we want to make sure it's a good quality, and so that's kind of where we were aiming for that.
Tell us a little bit about your process. So you have 25 milking goats, so you're a pretty small operation,
mm-hmm.
although I'm sure that doesn't feel small to you when you're you're doing the work.
No, it's a pretty labor-intensive day. You have 3 hours of milking in the morning and night, and then every day there's a phase of the cheese-making process. And then, of course, you have livestock care in addition to the cheese making process. So they are pretty long days, but with goat cheese, it does end up to be seasonal. So we're just winding down right now.
Okay, and why is it seasonal?
Because they try to follow the natural cycles of the goats for breeding. So I actually do artificial insemination, but we bring in a stinky buck for a couple weeks, and so then they have the babies in the spring, and it's really neat because everybody's so ready for the fresh cheese, and it's something they all look forward to.
All right, and baby goats are a lot of fun to have around too, I'm sure.
Yes.
And your goats actually go out and browse the hills on your farm in western Iowa.
Yes, kind of like what Gordon was mentioning, it makes they have a good goat life here. So we do hikes every day, and they stay out there till about 4 and with their Great Pyrenees buddy. And
a guard dog to keep them safe?
Right, exactly, Tucker. And then the neat thing about that is then that vegetation flavors the cheese and makes it unique to anywhere else in the world.
And how would you describe your cheese? And I've eaten your cheese, and it's really, really delicious. But how would you describe it?
I would say it's fresh and light and a little peppery. So I do have, we have the Simply Pure cheese, and then we have 2 organic farms within a mile of here, and so we get to do some nice herbs and flavors, and everything's really fresh and good.
So you have a fairly small operation. You're taking care of the goats, you're milking them, you're making the cheese, you're also the marketer, and you fill all of these different roles. How many people, or how large an area do you sell your cheese in?
More regional. We do go out to Iowa City. We were in the Lucky's Market out there and a couple restaurants. And then I have some high-scale restaurants in, I'm on the Nebraska border, so in Omaha, and then in the Hy-Vee grocery stores. So, but it's a good selection of, retail-wholesale balance. And then we... you know, tend to just do, you know, the farmers markets and those kind of outlets that are more traditional, too.
Now, you are an award-winning cheese. Do you find that you can meet demand for the cheese that you're making?
We typically do sell out. I make, you know, again, we are small scale, but I do, even just with those 25 mamas, we do 600 pounds of cheese a month.
Wow.
And so I sell them in 4-ounce containers. So that's a lot of old 4-ounce containers to crank out.
Yes. So in this world, do you, I realize that this is a later career for you, and it was a lifestyle decision in addition to being what you wanted to do. But do you find that this is something you can do and make money at?
You know, yeah, it's always that balance. So we're always trying to improve. Let's just say that. A lot of people like the cheese, and we do some ecotourism here. So we're really proud of the fact that we are in that national cheese competition and got second place. And then we also have an award-winning tour that we do with 8 other artisan vendors in this area.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Sharon Omek of Honey Creek Creamery in the Luss Hills. And Gordon, you've taken a look at cheese making all around the United States. You have a bias toward California. And I have to say, I don't know very much about cheese making in California. But tell me about some of the hot spots in the United States for artisan cheese.
Sure. You know, I'm not even sure I have a bias for California, and I can admit that on Iowa Public Radio. But you know, one of the main differences between states is, you know, California, you know, in Wisconsin, the average number for dairy cows on a farm is still about 100. In California, it's 850. So it's a lot more large scale and industrial in California to a large extent. So there's some smaller producers, but it can be a challenge in California. And even some of the original small producers have now gotten big. So it's a unique kind of thing. But I'd say hotspots in the United States, there's always Wisconsin. I mean, you can't ignore Wisconsin. They make more cheese than any other state in the country.
Right. Well, and you write about the enthusiasm that people from Wisconsin have for cheese. There's a real pride.
Well, you know, you get out of the airport when you land in Wisconsin, and you tell the cab driver or whatever that you're a cheese person. Any other state, they either don't really care or they'll ask you a question. In Wisconsin, they tell you what you should know. You know, in Wisconsin, you get into the cab and they start, well, you should be carrying this cheese. This is the best cheese in the country. You know, they were very, very proud of cheese in Wisconsin. I think one of the most interesting places for cheese right now, though, is the South. People are realizing that the South has never been a part of the country that's made a lot of cheese. But people are realizing that they can graze year-round in a lot of parts of the South and are making really amazing cheese that, unfortunately, is not really well-distributed yet. So it's hard to taste outside that region. But that's kind of the up-and-coming area for me. And also, Pacific Northwest is kind of underrepresented. A lot of farmstead cheesemakers making interesting stuff in Oregon and Washington as well.
Well, and I can imagine, we were just talking about, you know, regional cheeses with Sharon and with CJ Bienert from the cheese shop earlier, that a lot of these cheeses probably don't make it outside of their regions, and maybe they shouldn't.
No, and I think that's the really great thing that's happening right now. It used to be that if you were a cheesemaker somewhere in the United States and you're making a cheese that wasn't, you know, super accessible to you know, selling in a grocery store. You know, it wasn't something you could cut down into blocks and things like that. Or maybe it cost a little more because the price actually reflected the cost of production rather than kind of the commodity system and scale. You know, you had to seek out people like me in San Francisco. You know, you had to be like, hey, you know, can you take some of my cheese? You know, because you couldn't find enough local people to buy it. But that's really changing now. And farmers markets, I think, are the biggest single influence on that. But people can make a living, you know, selling in their local area. And a lot of times I get shut out of cheese because I'm not in the local area. And I think that's great. You know, if I call somebody up and I'm like, hey, can I buy your cheese? And they're like, nah, you know, we sell out, you know, in Iowa and Nebraska. You know, we don't have enough for you. I actually think that's a great development, not something I'm upset about.
It makes me wonder if we'll see a future of maybe cheese tourism getting to be as popular as wine tourism.
I think it's definitely possible. And I think, you know, Sharon, you know, mentioned her tour, and there's definitely a local goat dairy near San Francisco that, I mean, they happen to be on the coast between San Francisco and Santa Cruz. So it's a great location. But, you know, they stopped selling to us because they were like, you know what, we need all of our cheese for our shop because we get so many visitors here that that we can sell all our cheese ourselves. You know, and that's another great development.
Well, and we were just talking with Sharon about her cheeses, her soft goat cheese, and there seems to be a lot more of that kind of cheese, I would say, available, certainly, than there was when I was growing up. But has there been a major growth in that area, the kinds of fresh cheeses that you can get?
Definitely there have, and I think there's been a much more the development of appreciation of that style of cheese. I think that, you know, it used to be, if you were looking for cheese, you know, it was like, oh, I want something that's so strong, it's going to hit me over the head, you know. But people, I think, are really appreciating kind of mellower styles now, and generally younger cheeses, at least of this style, tend to be milder cheeses. The other thing to know about in terms of surviving for, you know, a farmstead dairy is that you want to produce some of these fresh cheeses because, you know, if you're making cheddar, that milk that you milk today, you're not going to see any money back from that for a year or 2 years. Whereas if you're making a fresh cheese, like a fresh Chev, you know, that's pretty much a you can be selling that cheese a couple days later. And that return, you know, that getting the money back into the farm is really crucial for the sustainability of small farmers.
Where do you think we'll see the most growth in the coming years?
I think that kind of what we've been talking about in terms of just real, more regional cheesemakers, people who are like, my goal is to make cheese for this area of the country, so that, you know, the stores here don't have to buy from California or Vermont or wherever. And I really think that that's what we're going to see the most of, that continuing development.
And back to cheddar, do you have a sort of a holy grail cheddar that's out there that you're looking for?
You mean in terms of buying for the store? Or
for you to eat?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the, you know, the Holy Grail cheddar is really, there. It is an English cheddar, even though I spent my whole book talking about American cheddars. you know, there's a cheese in England called Montgomery's cheddar, and it's still made in the area around the village of Cheddar. And what's really interesting about that is, you know, I briefly mentioned you know, cultures before, and I don't get too esoteric on the radio, but basically the folks at Montgomery, who make the Montgomery's cheddar, still make their own cultures. They carry it over. So it's like, you know, it's like your bread starter or your vinegar mother, you know, it's like they carry over the cultures and they make them themselves. So it has just a really distinct flavor. And I think that that's one of the most traditional and special cheddars in the world.
Gordon, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
It was so much fun. Gordon Edgar is the author of Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.